Those in the adult class, we are continuing our discussion of desirable characteristics, and we have come to lesson 16 in that series, which is the patience of Job. You'll notice that there are three verses. The first two are taken from the first couple of chapters of Job, and the third one is writer James, who comments upon Job and his patience in James chapter 5 and verse 11. Let's go ahead and begin by reading those. At least we'll start with the two that are found here in the book of Job. And in this particular context, we just note quickly the account that all of us are familiar with concerning Satan's attack upon the character of Job. Job as the Lord extolled Job as a good example of a righteous individual. Verse 8 of Job chapter 1 asks the question, "Have you considered my servant Job that there is none like him on the earth? A blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil." Satan had answered him with a challenge, is indicating his contention that the reason why Job was as he was because he had made a hedge around him. Jehovah God had and protected him. That if he would remove that hedge of protection, that Job would not be righteous. We're told in verse 11, Satan's challenge, "Stretch out your hand and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face." Now, I don't want to give Satan credit at all. He certainly was wrong in this case. But it is not an uncommon thing to see individuals who have been touched with adversity as a result of that adversity to curse God, and perhaps even to his face, to be very bold in their cursing of God. But of course, God had confidence in the character of Job and allowed Satan to take from him his possessions and his children. And you'll notice in verse 22 of the text, this first attack that was made upon Job when he lost all of his property as well as his children. We're told in verse 20, Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And then the summary statement in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. So there is, an important aspect to note with regard to that summary statement, is that despite the adversity, Job did not sin. So if we want to be defining what patience is, as we discuss Job as an example, we're going to have to recognize that it has something to do with the fact that through the adversity, he did not act in an unrighteous way. He did not sin. In chapter 2, Satan came back to the Lord, to his presence, and he talked again in verse 3, Jehovah did, about Job. "There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God, shuns evil, and he still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." So Satan's answer in verse 4 was skin for skin. "All that a man has, he will give for his life. Stretch out your hand now, touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face." Now, the Lord was not willing for Job to lose his life, and so his instructions to Satan with regard to the testing of Job was limited somewhat, but he did allow him to touch his person on this occasion. So, in verse 6, he said, "He is in your hand," having reference to his personal health. "But spare his life." And so Satan in verse 7 went out from the presence of the Lord, struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. This caused, as Joel had read just a few moments ago, for his wife to say, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he responded in the same way that he did in chapter 1 and verse 22 by calling her a foolish woman in that. And I like the wording of the New King James better than the King James. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And because the trial, tribulation, the adversity is what is, at least in our study this this evening, what is of greatest importance. But you'll notice the summary statement given in verse 9 as well, that in all this Job did not sin with his lips. So chapter 1 and verse 22, in all this Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. And verse 10, chapter 2, in all this Job did not sin with his lips. So keep the account in mind. Of course, the account of his adversity that he suffered at the hands of Satan is only a small portion of the book. There is a large portion taken up with regard to the counsel and conversation that he had with his three friends. And then a question and God's answer to his question that makes up the last couple of chapters of the book. You'll notice in James chapter 5 and verse 11, a statement that is made by James concerning Job as an example. We are told, "We count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job." Some versions render that patience. Patience of Job, perseverance of Job. "And in seeing the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful." So there are a couple of things to make note of, and then we'll, I think, open it up for some further discussion. But I want to note, especially in verse 11 of the text, two things. One is the statement that we count them blessed who endure, that there is a legitimate cause for praise and adoration concerning individuals who have persevered through difficulties. We have any number of examples that we can look at in Scripture. Job is just the one that is most common, of individuals who have gone through a difficult time in their lives and maintained their steadfastness before God, and thus, through such patience, proved themselves, shown themselves to be worthy, just as Job did. And we recognize that, and we count them as blessed. We acknowledge, recognize the laudable nature of such strength of character that will cause an individual to be able to withstand those difficult things without sinning, without growing despondent, without blaming God for the circumstances that are in your life. The second thing is, I think, the reason why this is not a vain pursuit, this concept of patience. And that is the end that we see with regard to the Lord. And this is something that is evident over and over and over and over again with regard to God's dealing with mankind, especially those who are righteous. That is, the end intended by the Lord is that the Lord is compassionate and merciful. And we have, again, abundant evidence that what we have as Christians to look forward to that will allow us to be steadfast and to persevere, be patient amidst trial and tribulation, is that realization of the end. That it's not about what's happening to me right now, but rather it's about what comes after. And that's the benefit that accrues to us as a result of our faithfulness. So when we're talking about patience, when we use the term patience commonly in our conversation, we talk about individuals who are willing to remain calm amidst provocation, to not react violently or inappropriately when someone either provokes us or when we become irritated or things do not work out as we would like them to be. We talk about patience, for example, that parents have with regard to their children, or teachers have with regard to their students, or employers have with their employees. We could go on and on and on with all the different examples where that kind of patience is needed. But that's really, though perhaps a part of the concept as is described there, it really doesn't touch the hem of garment as to what this term, both by definition, as we look at, for example, James chapter 5, when the word in the King James, New King James is translated perseverance, as well as the example that we have, that we're examining here with regard to Job, with regard to his patience. The word that's used in the Greek And I never can. I always forget to look up the pronunciation of the word. The anglicized spelling of the word is H-U-P-O-M-O-N-E. And that word is defined by Thayer as steadfastness, constancy, endurance. So keep in mind especially the idea of constancy. Because when you're talking about constancy, there's no deviation from the path. And that's something that Job showed as our example. An individual that never wavered with regard to his characterization of God as righteous. And God is good. And God is worthy of worship and worthy of praise. So he was constant despite the tribulation that beset him. In the New Testament, the word is used as a characteristic of a man who is unswerved from his deliberate purpose and his loyalty to faith and piety. I think that's a good definition describing the kind of thing that we're talking about, which is a bit deeper than what the common English term of patience refers to. To give you the full reading there, the characteristic of a man who is unswerved from his deliberate purpose and his loyalty to faith and piety by even the greatest trials and sufferings, no matter how difficult his life might get, no matter what provocation may be there, what tribulation or persecution may beset him, there's going to be that constancy, that unswerving dedication to that path, to his faith, to his pious living before God. There is no ability to shake him with regard to his faith, and as such his standing before God. So, again, Job serves as a wonderful example of that man who truly lost everything. And yet, despite losing everything, he did not sin with his lips. There's one other quote that I want to give you. This one from a commentator. His name is William Barclay. I've got his as well as some other notes, of course, in my library. And this is a common commentary. But he has something very interesting to say about this. He said, normally, this Greek word, which is one of the most noble of New Testament words, is translated patience or endurance, but there is no single English word which transmits all the fullness of its meaning. It has one very interesting use. It is used of the ability of a plant to live under hard and unfavorable circumstances. So when you think about that, it amazes me sometimes the weeds that come up through my cement and on my back porch, and how you wouldn't think anything could grow under those conditions of those circumstances, but the plant is able to do that, and it's amazing how plants sometimes can do that. But he says it's not the patience which can sit down and bow its head and let things descend upon it and passively endure until the storm has passed. Rather, it is the spirit which can bear things, not simply with resignation, but with blazing hope. And I really thought that was a good quote. There are an awful lot of people who will resign themselves. They have a very fatalistic mindset when it comes to their life on this earth. They're resigned to the fact that they're going to be kicked, they're going to be mistreated, they're going to be beaten down, their life is going to be miserable. And what, in effect, is that kind of endurance is simply the breaking of the spirit. There's just nothing left with which to fight back. And they lose hope. And that's not what steadfastness is. That's not what endurance, that's not what patience is. But rather, it can bear things, not simply with resignation, but with blazing hope. The spirit which bears things because it knows that these things are leading to a goal of glory. It's not the patience which grimly waits for the end, but the patience which radiantly hopes for the dawn. I thought that was a very good quote and a very good way of capturing the concept, again, that we see expressed in the example of Job, but also as we see as defined by the concept of the passage, the word that is used a number of different times that is translated either patience or perseverance in the New Testament. Okay, so those are some common introductory thoughts to think about. Anybody have anything they want to add up to this point? Hey, Scott?
The difference between the King James and the New King James, the patience versus the apparent perseverance, you just said it on the chin and just said it. endure. But with perseverance, you have your eye and your will upon the goal that you're after.
Very good, very good. And I do think that perhaps the easy way to explain the difference as far as how patience is normally used and what's under, it's just a stronger term. It's more significant of Christian character. It is something that indicates a much higher ceiling before the limit is reached than what we think about when we talk about patience generally. You ever heard of a t-shirt or a slogan? I've seen it a number of times where it's got a cartoon of a cat that's kind of with the fur sticking straight up, and it says, I'm down to my last nerve and it's frazzled, or you're plucking on it or something. You know, it's like, I'm to the point where I'm not going to be able to handle anymore, and then that's it, you know, and watch out. And really, there's no end in this regard. If you think about what Job experienced on this earth, nobody suffered more than he did. Loss of life, loss of property, loss of even his health. And yet, he did not sin with his lips. If we have this proper steadfastness, this ability to persevere, then the devil's not going to be successful in his assault on our character any more than he was with regard to Job. Yes, Monty?
Interesting. I think I've always had a misconstrued definition of what patience is. Growing up in the valley, I've been through a couple of hurricanes, and when you kind of sit through the hurricanes and you're going to be too bad, you get like a storm coming in, you just have to wait, and you can't do anything. So I've always kind of thought of synonymous with patience with just waiting. But it's really not, it's not just taking it, you don't just take it, you're being proactive, you do something. I think it's not really something
that's... I mean, waiting's a part of it, it's how you wait.
It's a part of it.
Yeah, sure.
I've always thought of enduring as far as like taking it and then it'll be over soon, as opposed to, well, what else do you do while you're taking it? You know, what else do you do?
Well, you know, you think about that because you're right. I mean, that's a common idea that we have about it. If that were the case with regard to Job, then what would Job's response have been to his wife? You know, and this would be the common response that you would hear individuals make as they acknowledge the existence of gods, and perhaps, and I use that because of the mythologies that are out there with regard to the fatalistic mindset of men as they are as they're mistreated by quote the gods. It's a very common concept that you hear. What happens is when people are asked about it as the gods have shown their disfavor, it's basically, well, you know, there's not much we can do about it because they're gods. So very fatalistic. And of course, with the Greek and Roman idea of mythology, the gods were flawed individuals that themselves were evil in many ways, but they had the superpowers and the position everywhere where men just had to take it. So that's a fatalism. Job didn't have that attitude. His wife did. It's again a very common attitude that's exhibited. When his wife saw what happened to him there in Job chapter 2 and verse 9, she said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity?" That's kind of a pretty stinging rebuke of him. What she was claiming is that for Job to maintain his sense of self-worth, integrity is something that we hold dear to, but it would be necessary for him to acknowledge that this God that he has placed all his trust in and all his faith in, this God is an evil God who is not worthy of such praise, not worthy of such adoration, not worthy of such loyalty. If you're going to be a man of integrity, you need to curse God and die. And so that's kind of the attitude that the wife had, okay? You know, you've prospered and such, and supposedly your God is the reason for all these things, but now look at how the way you are. If you have integrity, you're going to hate God instead of loving God. But his answer instead was not an answer which indicated understanding of what was going on or why it was happening. In fact, as we get to the end of the study of Job, we find Job asking that question and daring to ask God, why me? And God's answer was really fairly severe in the rebuke of Job and daring to question it. But what we do see in verse 10 of the text is that recognition that he is God and that we have no right to question him. And as such, he acknowledged his place and acknowledged God's place and did not feel it right and did not stoop down to saying anything evil against God at all. And that's something that is different from the common idea about, you know, if the gods don't like us or if God hates me, I can't do anything about it because he's God. Well, that's a bad way of thinking about God, is that he would be someone he would hate. And when you look at James chapter 5, using in verse 11 Job as the example, you've heard of the perseverance of Job, seen the end intended. And that is especially true. Perhaps the specific application is with regard to Job. You've seen the end intended because all things will return to him and multiply as God restored those things to him. God is compassionate, is merciful. So that leads us to learn from this that even if we're in the midst of a difficulty in our life, we're hurting, we're evil things have befallen us, we should endure it and not blame God. Because in the end, that God intends is mercy and compassion for us, just as he did with Job. Yes, God.
Two thoughts, if I may. First thought would be, this takes, and I've recently read through the whole book of Job, and I look at the immense wisdom that Job pours forth on his part, and the intense, albeit oftentimes wrong, logic that seems right, but isn't right, of his friends. I would not have been able to answer in the way that Job did throughout the entire book. So he has extreme wisdom in being able to do these things, to appropriately state that naked I came out of my mother's womb, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, so forth and so on. That comes from wisdom, which comes from maturity, as we read in Proverbs. To be wise is to be mature. And that can come no matter your age, per se. There are some things that, if you have wisdom, that are enhanced by years. But wisdom comes, maturity comes from wisdom, to be quite honest. And I see being mature and being wise as being a part of what caused this this response of patience. As you see throughout the book of Proverbs, how a slow answer is wise, how being slow to anger is wise. But having said that, the second point that I do want to make is, after having said that the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, it says, in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Okay, and also in verse 10 of chapter 2, it says, after he's rebuked his wife, says, in all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, you get further back into the book in chapter 32. Elihu comes into the scene. He says, so these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Verse 1. Elihu burned with anger because Job justified himself rather than God. And he burned also at Job's three friends because they found no answer, although they had declared Job in the wrong. Job, by the end of it, even though he exercised nearly impossible for me maturity, at least at this point in my life. He still fell into justifying himself rather than God, and I believe that is why twice the Lord says, dress for action like a man, and I will question you, and you will make it known to me. And then he says, and this is chapter 40, says in verse 8, will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be right? See, God picked up on that, but he understood what Job had gone through. And basically he goes throughout putting Job in his proper place. But when it says in chapter 1 and chapter 2 that in all this Job did not sin, in all that which was recorded to that point, Job had not sinned.
Yeah, yeah.
So after that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the statement Job 1 and 2 is not an indication that Job never sinned again, or that there weren't later events
okay.
where he acted inappropriately. I think that it's obvious with regard to the question with which he questioned God that he was, that his questioning was inappropriate. You know, in other words, despite all the things that had happened to him, when he basically said, God, why me? He was demanding something that he had no right to demand of God, which
Correct.
Was an inappropriate response. I think that everyone understands that with regard to the summary statement there in chapter 2, verse 10. Justin Jessup?
I was just going to say, I was disappointed in some of the translations that we've been looking at this. The New American Standard says, through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. And blame's not a very good word there. We've said it a couple times here in class that he didn't blame God. Well, he did blame God. He blamed God, and he attributed it to God.
He attributed it to God, yes.
But we get this idea that he didn't blame them, because blame has this negative connotation. But there isn't a negative definition. The New King James says, charge him with wrong. Well, okay, God did, but it wasn't wrong. And some of the translations say attributed as folly to God. It wasn't a capricious thing, like a lot of the gods of that time and the Greek gods later would have attributed to them, or, oh, here's a human and it's a plaything, I'll just do this thing to it. Job didn't attribute it to God like that. He did attribute it to God, and that was his point to his wife, was God wants me to suffer right now. He wants me to suffer.
And which is true, too.
Yeah.
In other words, there's a... It's the same thing happens today. You have... most people, when they read this account of what happened to Job, and this is, you know, one of the few times when we have the ability to kind of peel back the veneer of our existence and our perception and see behind the scenes, because we have reported for us a conversation between God and Satan in this case. And there is even that statement that is made there in verse 3 of chapter 2 by God himself. Have you considered my servant Job, none like him on earth, one blameless, upright, one who fears God shuns evil. He still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him. You incited me against him. Now, again, we have to understand whether we use the term blame is used or as is mentioned, which you're right, may not be the best definition with regard to charging God with wrong, which is why we use the term normally ourselves. But the same thing with the word incite here. You know, when you talk about inciting today, the idea is that you prod someone until they basically lose control and do something rash. That's an inciting to riot, for example. And that's not what God meant here. There was a challenge, and Satan had to be taught a lesson. And God used Job righteously. He's God, and he did nothing wrong. There was nothing, no folly, no wrongdoing in regard to this. But a lesson was being taught, an object lesson was being taught to Satan. And Job was used. So certain things were allowed, certain liberties were allowed by God to Satan that impacted Job's life. Job had no idea of what was going on in the background. But he understood that these things that happened, that God ultimately is in control, and He was, and He is today. And when we talk about, you know, we'll talk about today, if bad things happen to us, trials and tribulations, well, whose fault is it? Well, it's, you know, when we talk about fault, now you're going in that value judgment again, and talking about blame and wrongness and those kinds of things. Satan's out to do us evil, do us wrong. God is sovereign. God is in control. God allows Satan to do these things. It is something that God allows. And in that sense, we find the exact same thing happening to us today as happened to Job. And it's a matter of degree somewhat, but not always, because there are individuals who have lived since that have suffered the same amount or near to the same amount as what Job suffered in this example. The key here is to know two things. Number one is that God is righteous, and the end of God, there's three things. The end of God desires is compassion and mercy, as indicated in James chapter 5. And the second thing is, because we're man and He's God, we don't have any right to question it. And that's where the world in general fails with regard to the example of Job, because they want to say, that's not a righteous God. They read it. I see what the conversation is. I'm telling you, that God is an evil God. And that they have more audacity even than Job had when he simply said, why me? Why is this happening to me? Job wasn't making an accusation, but he didn't understand it. But God's answer was very stern to Job. Who are you to ask me anything? Where were you when I created the universe? You're not the all-powerful one, I am. And that's an attitude that I'm afraid is sorely lacking in our society. People just do not hesitate to question God and to blame God and to speak of God's character as being less than righteous and less than good, less than perfect. And we don't have the right to do that. And God is not going to put up with it. And it's pretty audacious thing for us to do. It's something that's commonly done today. Again, we go well beyond what Job did. And I'm reminded of what the psalmist said. It is the fool, West Texas pronunciation. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. I think that's an interesting thing. Someone has that boldness to think to themselves, God doesn't exist. Well, they're foolish. What about the one who actually proclaims it, who actually says it out loud? And I think that there are many who have gone well beyond that foolishness to something that is far worse. So just some things to think about. We look at Job chapters 1 and 2. We read what went on. And we see what's going on. We understand that Job is, in a sense, a pawn in this conflict between God and Satan. Whether or not we can fully comprehend why it is the case, this was a righteous thing and a good thing that God was doing. And God, in the end, in the restoration, showed His righteousness with regard to His treatment of Job. And Satan was taught the lesson that Satan needed to be taught. And we might not see it, but we have absolutely no right to proclaim God as being unrighteous, as we read. So, just something to think about. Yes, sir.
You covered something that we talked about. And I go back to verse 10, where it talks about accepting good from God, and shall we not accept the mercy? I think too often we forget the blessings so much outweigh the mercy that's in our life. And yes, Joel had a lot of mercies happen in life, but he did not blame God for these things. We just accept that they are part of life.
And there's another way in which that actually can show itself, and I think that you see examples of that with regard to the children of Israel, with regard to the adversity and blessings. The interesting thing about Israel, and I think they learned the lesson enough, but when the good things were happening to them, they didn't attribute that to God. They kind of went the opposite. They weren't willing to acknowledge that God was the font of those blessings. And so they basically said, it's because of us. And then when God brought them low by judgment, then they turned to Him in the midst of their trial and tribulation, because at that point they felt weak. So you can actually work both ways. And what we need to acknowledge is that the blessings come from God, and the adversity is something that, again, ultimately emanates from God as well. But as Christians, we recognize it, as Job did, and then we see what happened after. We see the end from the beginning. And as such, we know that ultimately and finally, that all accounts will be settled. And for the child of God, there is that hope of heaven, which allows us to be steadfast during the difficulties. Yes, Mono?
In the process of the kind of those four study of patience and endurance and stuff, it reminds me of 2 Peter, first chapter, adding on to your faith, virtue, and merit. So I'll kind of turn to that and read through that. And as a matter of, I guess, application, when it's kind of the second part of this lesson, right?
Right.
It's nice that we can see the curtains pull back and see the conversation between God and Satan, but also, you know, Job didn't know what was going on. At this point, he didn't know what's going on. So when I read 2 Peter about the things that are happening, we see an example of these things that we see in 2 Peter applying to Job. So read 2 Peter verse 5. For this very reason, also applying all diligence in your faith, applying moral excellence, which you have that
yeah.
to be as your officials.
Yes.
And in your moral excellence and knowledge, he had an understanding of it. And what, you know, he had an understanding of God and his ability to grow. Self-control, and your self-control, perseverance, and perseverance, godliness. And I love how this is, because we turn to this often, it's one of my favorite passages, but you see it really exemplified in Job. You see that example put into Job. And then if you go on further on, in 2 Peter, it says, verse 8, for these qualities are yours and are increasing. They render you neither useless nor unfruitful in the true knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. For he who lacks his qualities is blind or short-sighted. And what do you see? When you listen to Job's wife talk to him about, you know, just curse God and die. Job was not short-sighted in that way. He had perspective. He understood. He didn't understand everything. So he had his faith, but he had perspective that there's something else going on, not just kind of thought about this. He had an idea of what was going on. And that kind of goes back to what you said. Something bad happens, you curse God early. You're being short-sighted. You don't have a perspective of looking forward to that. So I just kind of.
Yeah, and that's the reason why God said, have you seen Job? There's none like him. I mean, he was a very righteous individual. He had fully developed those characteristics that were listed in 2 Peter 1.
Yeah,
and it was evident.
I think when you look at it as a theoretical aspect, but
there's a
good
use
of that, you really see it in Job, and that's very good point.
Good point. Now, giving all diligence, add to. So how do we add perseverance? It's a practical question. How do we add?
Knowledge.
Okay, knowledge.
Okay. Just do it.
Just do it. We've been saying that with every one of these characteristics. Just do it. And there's truth to that. I recognize that is the case. Yes, Ron?
I point out that Job didn't take all of this quiet. Patience doesn't mean that we just keep our mouth open shut. We sometimes think that we can't even complain. In the third chapter, Job begins to complain mightily about him being born, and the wicked don't get punished. And he concludes the whole that chapter by saying, my sighing comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet, for I have no rest, for trouble comes. We don't have to take our situation quietly. But don't sin against God. That's what Job was doing.
And it wasn't unrighteous for him to express his great pain.
Pain
in circumstances. So, good one. You ever heard the statement? Because I know you have, because I've said it, but you've met others as well. But be careful. Be careful what you pray for. If you pray for patience, you may be sent tribulation. And that's one of the things that happens, is that patience is developed by experience. Perseverance is developed by experience. And we say a great deal about individuals who have been tested. They've come through the crucible, whatever the crucible is, whatever it is that that they've come through that has filled them, it has toughened them, it has strengthened them. And the fact is that perseverance and patience is something that each and every one of us will have ample opportunity to develop. Because each and every one of us will have times in our lives when we will be beset with difficulties. So what we need to do is to steel ourselves. That second in the list there in 2 Peter 1, the moral excellence, the virtue, it touches on the proper response to those tribulations. So if you do as Job did, and steel yourself when these things happening, recognizing that God is righteous, that I am being tested, or I am being tried, I'm being tormented perhaps, or provoked, but my response is to be a righteous response. And by doing that, each time you do it, you grow stronger as a result of it. And you develop that process. Children don't have patience and perseverance. If some have a modicum of it, they're older than their years in regard to the maturity. It takes experience to attain that. Yes.
With any of those other things, you can either go through the trial or you can witness the trial. And if you witness other people that are persevering, and like you said, not just taking it, but who are undergoing a trial and are still going out and working, or undergoing a trial and are active servants of God, and you empathize with that, you can say, wow, look at that. I should be bearing up a lot better under the little things I am now. And you put yourself in those mindsets when the bigger things come.
Good. Yes. Learn. You can learn the hard way or the easy way, and the easy way is always by following the examples of the righteous. So that's a very good point. We'll pick up with the morals of Joseph in our discussion next week. Okay. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.